This podcast is made possible by the generosity of supporting members. Please visit dharmaocean.org to learn more about becoming a supporting member. You are listening to the Dharma Ocean podcast. In this talk, Reggie explores how human sadness points to a fundamental sense of disconnection from the totality. Sadness, he says, illuminates our longing to release the veils of ignorance and unite with the limitless space of being. It brings us to the cushion. This talk was given at the 2005 Winter Datun Retreat, held in Crestone, Colorado.
Trungpa Rinpoche says in his Dzogchen teachings that in the human person there's a tremendous sadness, always. And the sadness is because we're separated. We're separated from the totality. We're separated from ourself. We're separated from the space of what is. And that sadness, when it's understood properly, becomes the inspiration for the path that we want to reunite. What usually happens with people is that they think that the sadness is about uniting with something relative, with power, you know, in the most crude aspects, with power, with fame, with social status, whatever, wealth. Or in a more sophisticated level, that they want to possess beautiful paintings, or they want to find that perfect relationship, or they want to somehow accomplish their work, you know, in a perfect way. But, you know, that still is misunderstanding what that longing and that human sadness is all about. But when we understand that sadness, when we feel it in our hearts and we actually understand what it's really about, which is about wanting to unite, wanting to let go into the space, into the Dharma Dhatu, to come home in that way, then the path actually becomes very simple and our life becomes very, very simple. And the motivation to practice is, you don't need to even worry about it because you see that's what you want. You want to be there and you want to be practicing and you want to begin to get to know that space and then begin to play in it, fly in it. As human beings, even after we've achieved realization, that sadness is always there. And it's interesting, if you read the life of the Buddha, and particularly the life by Ashvaghosha, called the Buddhacharita, which is a very extraordinarily profound, spiritually very profound text. And I don't think there's any other life of the Buddha that has the kind of depth of understanding that that text does. When the Buddha is getting ready to die, a lot of his students are upset. You know, upset that he's about to leave. And he says, basically, you should realize what's going on here, that the fulfillment of my whole life is about to happen. You know, during his life, he knew that freedom, and, you know, part of him just wanted to be there all the time. And yet, the nature of the world and the nature of even the sensory experience itself, you know, pulls you out. Even though, you know, we can talk about the senses are the gate to the vastness. Nevertheless, as he says, this is what he says. He says, as long as we're embodied, there is still some separation. There's still some kind of veil between us and what we long for. So he says, basically, you have to realize what's going on here is that I'm about to let go of this mortal coil and release myself into this thing that I have always wanted. And, you know, his kindness and his compassion was that he held back from that his whole life. He didn't really have to. He didn't really have to do it, but he chose, in order to help his students, to stay with it, you know, all those years from the time of his enlightenment, which was 35, which is basically when he could have let go until he was 80. That's a long time. That's 45 years that he was willing to hang out on this side. So, you know, that's the human condition, and there is a great sense of longing, and even after realization, there's still that veil. Sometimes you read stories of the great teachers and their time of death, and of the 10th Trungpa, the predecessor to Chogyam Trungpa, it's said that on the day of his death, the man was so cheerful. He was a happy person. And he was pretty old, too. He might have been, I don't know how old he was, but I think he might have been 80. I don't really remember. But he got up in the morning, and he was very cheerful, and he told his attendant, you know, his attendant said, you know, Rinpoche, you need a new robe. And he said, well, you better make it a small one. So he knew, you know, he knew finally after all this work and working with all these people and all the hassles and all the strain and all the struggle, you know, finally he was going to be able to fly free. So the reason I mention this is that it's, number one, the feeling of sadness is, it's with all of us, and it's underneath everything else, whatever running around we do, whatever ways we have of distracting ourselves, whatever ways we have of thinking that we've actually found something, nevertheless, it's always there. And this is not something that is going to be resolved in the near future. I just thought you should be reminded of that. You know, when we talk about the First Noble Truth, this is the secret teaching of the First Noble Truth, that actually the First Noble Truth is about that sadness. That as long as we are separate, we're never going to feel completely okay. It's never going to happen. And it doesn't matter how much we achieve spiritually. It doesn't matter anything. You know, none of it matters. There are going to be moments when we forget it. That's true. And there are going to be moments of complete release when it's not evident. But nevertheless, it's always there. And so the first thing is just to remember that that sadness is, it's not because we're doing something wrong, and it's not because we need to kind of get it right, and it's not something that is going to disappear in the near future. It's actually fundamental to our condition. And it's actually a marker of our human condition and our separation and our longing and what we are longing for. And then the second thing is, if we actually understand the sadness properly, that's the motivation for practice. And sometimes when you're practicing, your mind is completely still, and there's still this pain in your heart. And that's what it's about. And if we measure everything in our life against that, you know, then it becomes a very important benchmark for us. And we're not looking so much out there anymore for that fulfillment. Once you understand the sadness, you realize that practice is actually the only thing that is really going to help us. It doesn't mean we don't get distracted from time to time, and it doesn't mean that we don't live our life in the world, but we're not asking the relative to fulfill the need for the absolute. Our problem is we're asking the relative all the time to fulfill the need for the ultimate. And it can't do that, and it never can. Only the ultimate. And what is the ultimate? It's the space of our own mind, the space of our own awareness, which is the space of all that is. It's the Dharma Dhatu, it's the totality of all being. If our realization was going to be less than the totality of all being, then it wouldn't be good enough. The only way we will ever be happy is if everything that ever was and ever is and ever will be is the same as the space of our own realization. If we become one with that, then there will be true peace. But until that happens, it's not going to happen. So, you know, keep that sadness with you. Remind yourselves of it. Let it come back. And let it be your guideline in your life. And the more you meditate, then the more all that's going on is that sense of separation and the longing to let go into the fullness of what is. So we have made a wonderful journey here. And one reason it's been wonderful is that no one can get their hands around it. We've had our individual journeys, and I think more than we realize, we've had a journey together. And there's some very strong karma in this place at this time. And I think we all feel it, and at the same time, we don't understand it, and we don't know where it's going. And when you do feel that way, then you're in the heart. You live in the heart of the world. In the heart of the world, all we know is the intensity and truth and reality of our own life. And we can feel the direction of unfolding, but we can't see the future, and we don't know how things are going to play out. And that is actually a sign of the tremendous authenticity of the situation. When we think that we know where things are going, then we have actually lost our own heart and our own life. So this is the heart of the world right here. Please don't forget what we've been through, don't forget what you've experienced, and don't forget that your lives can be this intense and this real and this transformative. There's going to be a certain tendency, which we all have, you know, much as we long for that union, there's also a tendency to run away from it. And it's just important to keep that in mind. And it's not personal, it's not because there's anything wrong with us, it's just the way human beings are. And the journey truly is running away and realizing we're running away and then coming back. And it works on the cushion, right? Same process. We run away into discursive thought, fantasies, whatever, and then we come back. And we need to do that in our daily lives also. We need to constantly come back. And, you know, this is the practicing lineage. This is the practicing lineage. This is the lineage that you have fallen into, the practicing lineage, which means that we practice. It means that we meditate. This is not the practice lineage. The practice lineage, you know, practice is a noun, a substantive. And that could be like, it could be institutional. It could be institutional. It could be like, well, I belong to this club called the practice lineage. That's not what we're doing. We are the practicing lineage, which means that we are defined by the fact that meditation is the basis of our human existence. And actually, meditation is the gate to our own fulfillment and the only gate. There is no other gate. There's some partial gates. But simply sitting, as we've been talking about, and allowing our process to unfold in its own way without any interference and any objections and any hesitation, that becomes possible through the practice of meditation. So we are practicing lineage. So, hence, ergo, the most important thing for you from now If I might say so with all due respect, now I'm going to become the fundamentalist preacher for a minute. From now until the day you die, is that you understand that meditation is your water of life. It is your nourishment. It is your elixir of immortality. It is the channel and the gate and the vehicle through which you can realize all of your dreams, the essence of all of your dreams, the essence of everything that you've ever wanted. It's so important to understand that. You need to implant this in your brains and in your hearts. You're here, and the door is open, and you're being invited. And my aspiration is that you don't deceive yourselves into thinking this is not real, or that I'm not telling the truth, or that the lineage is bogus, or, even worse, that you can find the fulfillment you're seeking in some relative way, by fulfilling some relative ambition in your lives. That's known as the view. And once we really understand that meditation is the Dharma, meditation is the way, again, life becomes simple. I know that a lot of times we feel that our lives are complicated. We have a lot of responsibilities. We have a lot of karma, actually, in the world of various kinds that we need to engage. And sometimes we feel that, well, you know, I really agree, you know, all of the Dharma and meditation and so on, but I can't do it now. I'll do it later. And I want to tell you that that is the biggest self-deception of all. If you care about yourselves truly, then you can make meditation the basis of your life, and I'm pretty sure that your lives will arrange themselves around your practice. This is something that, you know, even the Dalai Lama, you know, the Dalai Lama is a pretty busy guy. He's a pretty busy guy. I mean, he's a world-famous figure. The entire Tibetan, you know, population in Tibet and in the diaspora look to him. He's the man. He's the one who's going to help us all. Because of the Nobel Peace Prize, he's internationally sought after by every peace group and every activist group, every engaged Buddhism group. You know, they all want a piece of him, and he provides it. But the man meditates 5 hours every single day of his life. And if the Dalai Lama can do it, then surely we can figure out a way to do it. And I'm not suggesting that what he does is he gets up at 4 a.m. and he practices from, 4:30 until 9:30 in the morning every day. I'm not suggesting that we should go to that length at this point in our lives. But I am suggesting that there's a lot more flexibility in our lives than we might realize. And we actually do have the capacity to make a commitment to meditation practice on a daily basis that is significant. We actually can do it, and we can find a way to do it. And in the beginning, it requires some commitment, and it requires a bit of a leap. And sometimes we have to work our way up to what we think we need to do. You know, we might, frankly, for this group, I think an hour a day is minimum. That's what I feel. And you should do more if you feel you need to. In my case, I do about 3.5 hours every morning. And it's not because I think, I'm going to be this great Buddhist. It's because I actually need to do that. At this point in my life, I can see what happens when I give myself that kind of space, and I see what my day is like and what my life is like, and I also see what happens when I don't do it. And it's not really something I have to have a debate about with myself, because I just see the impact I see. And I encourage you also to take that approach of start with an hour And, you know, if it's in the morning, that's good, but sometimes it's at noon and sometimes it's in the evening. I mean, whatever you can do based on your life. But don't make excuses. It is so easy to make excuses for oneself and to put it off. So I encourage you to listen for the lineage and to follow their prompting and to do your hour a day. And if you could do more, you should. If you can do an hour and a half, an hour and 45 minutes, you'll see. There's a whole journey that happens when you sit that way every day. It's very, very good, and it deepens you in a very rapid manner. But that will happen with an hour a day also. And then I would suggest once a week that you sit for 3 or 4 hours in a stretch, the way we've been doing here. And I would suggest that you do it on a day off, you know, on the weekend, if you have the weekends off. And this will have a huge impact on you. The effect of daily sitting and weekly sitting is, strangely enough, that not only does your own state of mind not become quite as frivolous and speedy and distracted, but that in living out of a greater depth in yourself, your life itself becomes much more effortless and much more natural. And as I was saying yesterday, the things that happen to you become part of the path, just in and of themselves. You don't have to really do anything about it. You don't have to kind of change yourself around in your daily life. This is how you actually do it through these practices. But then the other thing that I've found in my own life and the life of people I work with over the years is that it actually changes your karmic situation in relationship to intensive practice. So the other thing that I suggest is, and this is going to be facilitated by the daily practice and the weekly intensive Nyintan thing, is that twice a year you try to do intensive practice. If you can come and do a Dhatun, that would be wonderful. And some of the people I work with have done 2 or 3 or 4, even 5 Dhatuns. The Dhatun, it's like a huge, huge, huge leap forward in your own development, and it doesn't matter when you do it. Even at my advanced age, this Dhatun, there were some things that were worked out here that I've been waiting on for, you know, 30 years. And every time I lead a Dhatun, my own process is just this huge, it's like a greenhouse where the all of the nutrients and all of the moisture and the sunlight and everything just, you know, it just enables things to go forward. So if you've done one Dhatun, that's fabulous, and it's opened up a lot of gates for you, but the more Dhatuns you can do, the better. I mean, this is a very, very powerful program. And I would say that's also true if you're a Vajrayana student. I mean, Dhatuns are good. Now, most people can't, because of their life circumstances, they can't do a whole Dhatun, but you can come for part of a Dhatun. And then there are other intensives that I lead throughout the year also. When you become, if and when you become Vajrayana students, you can come to the Vajrayana training intensive, you can do Mahamudra programs, and there are other things that I do. So there are the intensive group practice that I would suggest. And that's one way you can fulfill this twice a year ideal situation. And of course, the other way is solitary retreat, individual solitary retreat. And those also are very, very important and incredibly transformative. Things happen in solitary retreat, similar to Dhatun, where your life is changed. And again, it's not a one-shot deal. Every time you do a retreat, 10 days, a month, whatever, you know, once in a while in your life, I hope you can do longer retreats, you come out a different person, and you really are a different person, and your world is a different world. This is the magic of the practice lineage, and this is the secret that is not told, that, you know, there's no need and no reason for us to circulate in the same frame of mind and the same habitual patterns, you know, none. We go through these processes of these intensive practice, either group practice or solitary retreat, you become a different person, and truly your world is a different world. And your challenge is to acknowledge it, is to see it, acknowledge it, and trust it. Because when you do your practice, it's going to happen. It does happen. As you'll see after Datin, you're not going back to the same world. Do you know that? It's going to be a different world. Everything is going to be different. Everything's going to look different, and it's actually going to be different. And you're going to find opportunities, you're going to find openings, you're going to find workability that wasn't there before. So it's just so very important to understand that about practice. If you want to change yourself and change your life and change the world, practice is actually the way you do it. When you begin to do Vajrayana practice, then you really can affect the world in a very direct way. And the practices are, you know, particularly used for the situations that cannot be, they're not exactly hands-on kind of thing. There's no way that you can make something happen by putting your hands on it in the normal way. However, using Vajrayana practice, things change. Now you might say, well, I thought the Vajrayana was about liberation. How come we're talking about power in the world? Well, everything, you know, this is where the Hinayana and Mahayana are so key, because the Hinayana is that you give up your own desire for personal happiness. In the Mahayana, you realize that things are groundless and you can't make them into territory. And coming out of that state of mind, you can work with the world. Of course, it's not for yourself. It's for others. But once you kind of take that attitude, you can do a lot of things, and your Vajrayana practice is your way. But it's not just true of Vajrayana, it's true of meditation altogether. That's how we change ourselves, that's how we work with other people, and that's how we change the world. Simply through the practice itself. Your meditation, your daily meditation, your weekly nyintons, and the intensive practice that I'm talking about here. So, I also want to say a little bit about the path, the kind of way of unfolding. The most important thing is that you understand that, you know, your evolution is, it's an inner thing with its own timing and its own way of proceeding. And whatever practice you do or programs you do are in service of that. So the first phase, which we call the Hinayana phase, is that we need to be stabilized in our meditation, which means that the kind of thing I'm talking about here is actually our life, that we find a way to do daily practice, weekly practice, and then intensives as we can. So meditation really needs to be a reliable and pretty automatic part of our life, and that takes some work. You know, we have to work that out. That's part of what the Hinayana is, that you actually lay that ground so you don't have to really think about it. And I know that sometimes we take the Bodhisattva vow before that's happened, but you still have to fulfill this Hinayana level before you can really go further. Very, very important. It's key. And then the second part of the Hinayana thing is that we're actually also stabilized in our mind. And what that means is that the intensity of this space is so much that in the beginning, that we get to a certain point, we actually can't work with our state of mind, and we have to do something different. But there has to be enough meditation so you actually know how to be with yourself and have the confidence and also the skills to work through whatever it is comes up, whatever it may be, claustrophobia, fear, freaking out. It is part of the journey, no problem. But to stabilize and establish the Hinayana, our meditation has to be a part of our life that we don't think about anymore because we just do it. And also our ability to work with our state of mind is all-inclusive, that we really can work with everything. And there aren't these sort of dark areas that we can't work with. So that's the Hinayana process. And everybody in this room needs to just kind of understand that and make that your goal. Until you do that, you can't really be a wholehearted Mahayana practitioner. Because as long as you have these things in yourself you're not willing to work with or can't, they're going to be the same exact things in other people that you're either not willing to work with or you can't. You see what I mean? So it's a very logical thing. So then at the Mahayana level, as the Hinayana thing matures and develops, the stabilization of one's practice and one's relationship to one's own mind, then on the Mahayana level, we gradually begin to see where we hold back from other people. And then that also becomes, after a while, it's not something you really think about. You know, you keep working on it, and at a certain point, that's just how you are as a person. That's the way you think. And that shows stabilization in the Mahayana. But again, that takes time to develop. It's not something that happens overnight. And the reason I'm bringing this up is quite a number of people are very inspired by the entering the Vajrayana practice. And I think that has to be a very individual thing. Again, the main point is where you're at, and especially on the Hinayana level. I mean, to me, that's the bottom line. It makes no sense to come to the Vajrayana training intensive if your practice is very scattered and inconsistent, and if you have large areas of your own mind that you actually can't relate to yet. It doesn't make sense, because in the Vajrayana, you see, the thing about the Vajrayana, it's a much more relaxed situation, and that kind of relaxation only works if we're stabilized in the Hinayana way. It doesn't work otherwise, because then the relaxation is just people are going to continue to not have the sort of inner sense of presence that's really needed. In the Vajrayana, you really have to be present and accounted for in a kind of continuous way. Do you understand what I'm saying? So I'm trying to present this in a way that you understand. I mean, it's not a sort of judgmental situation. It's just an evolutionary thing. It's like when a child is learning to walk, you don't give them a bicycle. I mean, it wouldn't make any sense. Once they've learned to walk, then they have to play, they have to climb, you know, jungle gym or whatever. And then at a certain point, giving them a bicycle makes a lot of sense. But it wouldn't make sense ahead of time because they wouldn't really be able to ride it. And that's the situation with the Vajrayana. So I think if you feel inspired to move forward into the Vajrayana, this is the kind of thing you might want to think about. And I would say, if you want to become Vajrayana practitioners, put your energy into these first, this Hinayana thing of stabilizing your practice and of seeing, you know, how much you're willing to accommodate and practice Maitri in relation to your own state of mind, so everything's included. Giving yourself time to really train properly, maybe do another Datan, and taking that time to really stabilize, train, and deepen.
To download more of Reggie's teachings, find out about upcoming retreats, and to explore a variety of audio listening guides to assist you on your spiritual journey, please visit dharmaocean.org. Music is by Jeff Beal and Nawang Ketchog from the album Tibet, Cry of the Snow Lion.